Well, how are you doing, Jeff? Jess, we've talked before.
Yeah, we talked about Job last time, and this time maybe we'll just talk more about kind of your project and what's going on, because I've been watching your videos, and I don't know if I can add anything to it, but.
No, it's well, and I think the Job conversation went very well. I think a lot of people really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I think so too. I was happy with all the comments. Everyone seemed to be jiving with it. I didn't really get any negative feedback at all.
I had a conversation with a guy who didn't want to be recorded, who I hope, you know, I always say I want to record it, because after you have the conversation, right, then it's like, I mean, even if you don't share it, you just have a record of it. And and it was really, and so he and I also talked about Job for a long time, and that part I think he really would wanted to have shared, and I don't have it, so.
Right. Was there anything insightful that he had?
Yeah, he was a mathematician from England, and had some really good, really interesting perspectives on math and Job, and really interesting stuff. And I don't have a record of it because I didn't record it, because, you know, people have legitimate reasons to not be recorded, and I want to honor that, but sometimes it's like, dude, you're killing me. We had this great conversation and it's gone.
Right. It's just like it never happened.
No. So I think I will talk to him again, and I think we will get some of that stuff up. So,
okay, cool.
But people really enjoyed your perspective on Job, and I'm really grateful. It was really good. So
yeah, thanks for doing that. That was a lot of fun.
I don't know. So what are you thinking about for today? Where do you want to start?
Well, I was kind of inspired. Like I was like, I got to talk to Paul again after you posted the Paul Maxwell stuff. And so I started going through a few of his videos, and he's really good. And then you also mentioned Peter Rollins. Someone had sent that video to you.
Yep.
And did you ever get a chance to watch that one?
Yeah, I started, in fact, chopping it up and really starting to process it. But then the Hain Style video came out, and then a few other videos came out, and it just kind of got, you know, so it's still there in my head. I want to do a video on that because it's an interesting conversation.
I've been following Rollins for like 10 years now.
Really?
And well, I mean, the last few years have been shaky because I got disillusioned with his project because it was, I mean, well, let me just, before I get going on Rollins, like maybe I can just sort of tell you where I came from, and how I got to Peterson and found you and all this. And Rollins plays a key role in my story. So, I grew up evangelical. I grew up in a Nazarene church. My parents got saved when I was about 8, and we started going to church regularly. So I basically just grew up in the church. I can't go into too much details with them because of what they do, but they basically, my dad was a professor at the University of Idaho. He taught electrical engineering, and he quit his job to do basic like ministry work, and my mom and him are still teaching to this day, like overseas teaching English, stuff like that.
Okay.
So they took seriously the idea that God wanted them to serve. And so during my childhood and stuff, we would go on different serving opportunities overseas and whatnot. So when I graduated high school, I was looking for an opportunity like that. So I found an organization called Youth with a Mission. You know Youth with a Mission?
Yep.
So for the next, I guess it's 4 or 5 years after high school, I was in Youth with a Mission doing missions work with short-term outreaches and stuff, and spent a lot of time in Asia. Went to Costa Rica and Mexico, took lots of youth groups, places, and stuff like that. My phone's buzzing. And And so I was one of the key things in Youth at the Mission was just that, you had to seek the voice of God and try to follow God and for yourself, like not only like the mission was there to provide some sort of structure, but Youth at the Mission is very loose structurally. And it's just like everyone can do what they feel called to, which is good because you can do what you feel called to, but it's bad because everyone's just doing what they feel called to. So it's a very open and wild kind of, or it can be some places in, like they have places all over the world. Anyway, don't want to get too far off track. Anyway, so I was going to try to be a missionary, and I was really trying to act out what I believe was the highest value and my, the highest, you know, I'm putting this in Petersonian terms. So I was trying to really act this out, and it was, I wanted God to tell me what to do, and I wanted to do it. And I figured the best thing and the hardest thing and the most important thing to do would be to try to go somewhere difficult and preach the gospel or help people or do that.
Yep.
The problem was, is that I could never get it to happen. So I would always try to set something up, and I'm young too, so I don't know what I'm doing anyway. And so I started going to school for business, to try to get a business degree. Cause there's a lot of guys I knew that were doing opening up coffee shops or small factories or whatever, and then proceeding to do ministry out of those locations. As well as just provide jobs and do good stuff. And I had kind of a crisis when I was 22, 23. I hated my business classes. I didn't know for sure if God wanted me to go overseas or not. And, you know, people would get up and they would say, God called me to Tibet. Or God called me to India and this specific people group. And I had on my heart, I wanted to go to North Korea. I was like, I'm going to go to the hardest place that's impossible to get to. And I'm going to,
you're probably going to be killed.
Right. Oh, but I even had like at that point I had like a martyr complex of some sort where I envision me sacrificing my life. I'm not going to live till I'm 30. I'm going to, you know, that kind of thing. So I could never make it happen, or God wouldn't make it happen, or I don't know what was going wrong. And so I was like, I came to this crisis point and I was just like, God, if you want me to go somewhere and do something, just tell me and I'll go do it. It was like a plea because I needed that. I couldn't keep going without having a clear direction. And so I was pleading with God because I was like, I don't like these business classes. I don't know what I'm doing right now. I gotta have a direction. Just tell me whatever it is. I don't even care. I'll do it. And he just said to me, he was like, what do you want to do? And I thought my answer would be, I thought it would be, you know, I want to do missions. I want to do it. But it wasn't. I wanted to play music. And I had been in a band. And immediately God said, just, we'll go do that. And technically I wanted to produce music. And so I was like, I already knew what the plan was. I already had like kind of been thinking about it, whatever. And so like I had kind of an uncalling experience where I got up in front of everyone in the mission during, like, we had a prayer and fasting day on a Friday. And so we were having just worship music and prayer and fasting. And, people would get up and they would either pray spontaneously or confess something or share something on their heart. So I got up and I told everyone that I wasn't called anymore, which is hilarious, that I was going to go do music production. And it was like this, it was like the antithesis of what normally happens when someone gets up and they're like, I'm called to Tibet. You know? Everyone was extremely supportive. Like, it couldn't have gone better. They totally didn't hear where I was coming from. And so anyway, I leave and I go to an audio engineering school in Arizona. And I, you know, it reminds me of when Peterson talks about Abraham leaving his tent and he immediately falls into a famine and then a tyranny. And like, school was great. You know, nothing terrible happened, but I had to do a mandatory internship in New York City. So I was like, here I go. God's going with me. I'm going to do it. And I spent 6 months doing my internship. I worked for free. I was just struggling. And there was just this endless wave of interns coming into New York City. And there was no job in sight. And I had no money. And I was just like, what am I going to do? So my brother was working in Omaha, Nebraska. And he's like, he had me come out, or his boss had me come out to help set up a project that had to do with some video editing or whatever. And I knew about that. And so I did that. He's like, if you ever need a job, just let me know. And I was like, oh, crap. And I was like, I need a job. So I left New York City and I moved to Omaha, Nebraska. And it was, it was the worst. I mean, there's good people in Omaha, but it was not good. And it was just like soul crushing. Cause I was like, I was going to go live my dream and I was going to go do something great. And that, you know, God's with me. And it was just like, no, nothing, nothing's working out.
You were going to go overseas and suffer for the Lord in North Korea.
Not Omaha.
Instead, he made you suffer in New York and Nebraska. And you didn't like it.
I know,
that's the funny thing about suffering for the Lord. Hey, you know what? It's still suffering.
I know. The amazing thing was, is when I'm on the move to Omaha, I met my wife. And so we ended up talking long distance and we ended up getting married and started family life. We moved to Kansas City and then had my first son and life started. And during this whole point from New York, and this, let's see, when did I leave New York? I left New York in 2004, got married in 2005. And so the next 10 years, I never really fell away from God, but I was struggling to figure out what God was, and because I knew God that was involved in missions, but I didn't know God that was in the world. Like I didn't know how he worked. So I was just trying to figure all that out. So about the time I came in contact with Rob Bell and started listening to his stuff. And then that's how I came in contact with Peter Rawlins. And he wrote a book in 2008 or 2009 called How Not to Speak of God. And he's got his PhD, I think, in post-structuralism or something. And so it's very postmodern deconstruction type of work. And so his thing, he would just, it was almost just sort of a game in that book where he would just have opposing concepts. It'd just be like theist, atheist. And he'd be like, when you know God, you don't know him. And when you don't know God, you know him. And kind of these just concepts coming out of the evangelical world, I was just like, it finally like was like unlocking stuff that I had kind of like just tightly gripped, you know, that I was just like, oh, okay, I can just let this go and not have to try to, you know, control my faith so much. So it was a very in like the Facebook groups and message boards around Rawlins' work, it's a lot of talk about deconstruction, and it's not technically what was it Derrida meant by deconstruction, but people just talk about their faith being deconstructed. So that's kind of what was going on. I was just breaking everything down. I never really let go of God, and we kept going to church and stuff. My wife was always a strong believer, but I was always kind of flirting with, you know, atheist thinkers and just all these thoughts. And I'm high in openness too, so I'm just going through like everything I could find that piques my interest. So where to go next? Yeah, so I guess, what was happening is I went through this deconstruction. So evangelicalism was a very tightly constrained system. And so this just opened all that up. But it came to a point where it was just like the nihilism and the hopelessness started to creep in. And you're like, okay, what's the game plan for this part? Like, what's the solution here? And I kept holding on to Rollins' work, but nothing was happening. Like, he just kept doing these things, just kind of pulling things apart and whatever. Which is helpful if you are, like, I think you think about it in Petersonian terms as it's the order and chaos. Like, if you're in too much order, you need some chaos, and chaos is good for you. So that's what Rollins was for me. But after a while, it just started getting too much. And I'm like, where's the order? And then to make it worse is just that huge disconnection in the materialist world between my faith and then science. And I could never just deny either God or evolution. And so this is like, I was waiting for someone to just make the connection, and no one was talking about it. The atheists were just dismissing this side, and all the Christians were just dismissing evolution and science. And I was like, I don't know where to go. Like, I didn't have the time or the ability or the resources to think about it. So when Peterson came along, it was the Joe Rogan podcast that he was first on. I was like, oh, this is it. You know, that he just did it. And I don't know. In a way, it saved my faith. But it was more than that, because for me, he just saved the whole world. You know, I'm not trying to be too dramatic about Peterson, but it really impacted me. And I was telling my friend once about a man. Sorry for crying.
That's okay. Don't worry about it.
But I was like, because we were talking about Peterson, and like a lot of my friends, like I was like, isn't this amazing? And they're like, I guess. And I have a couple friends that like they were. They're still disappointed in me. they're my good friends. I still talk to them. They're still good friends, but they're very disappointed in me.
Oh, join the club on that score. I got a lot of people disappointed in me.
But I was telling my one friend when I was explaining like why this was such a big deal, I was like, well, because the God I wanted was a God of the whole world. He wasn't just the God of one area or another. So it was this huge, huge deal for me. So anyway, so I've stayed in contact with Peter Rollins' work, and I've been trying to make sense of it. And I was watching before Peterson, as I was trying to piece things together, I got into Marxism, just like trying to figure it out intellectually. So I was listening to lecture after lecture after lecture, you know, college level lecture on Marxism, trying to figure it out. And it was a good critique of capitalism or whatever. Yeah. And then I was listening to a lot of Zizek, who influences Rollins a lot. So I've listened to hundreds of hours of Zizek. And Zizek's really, I like him a lot. I think he's really good. And, you know, he's a Marxist or self-proclaimed Marxist or whatever, but he's not like he's not the ones that, you know, sometimes when Peterson goes off about postmodernism and Marxist, I'm like, well, that's not Zizek. Zizek's doing something a little more interesting. Anyway, Peter Rollins never comes back to this, never establishes any sort of order. He leaves that just totally unspoken. And he just is kind of in the realm of deconstructing things, which is super helpful from everyone coming from the religious background. Mm-hmm. And so in that video, he talks about that instinct versus desire. Mm-hmm. I like what he had to say about Peterson. He had a good summary of Peterson that I thought it was interesting how what he grabbed onto and how he phrased it. Mm-hmm. And how he said that Peterson wants balance and harmony. Mm-hmm. And I think that's pretty good. I think the Jungian world seeks balance and harmony. I think it's not so simple as Rollins put it, because there is the individual in Christ that bridges the gap.
No, I thought Rollins in that video was very fair to Peterson. I thought he was very accurate.
Yeah. I was a little bit surprised.
Yeah. No, it was very good.
Yeah, so he goes off onto his thing about that it's instinct versus drive. And then I was just thinking about that. And that was kind of like the core of at least one of the major parts of what he had to say. And I was like, or instinct versus desire. Did I say drive?
Yeah. Yeah.
How do you differentiate between instinct and desire?
Right.
Like, that's I feel like the whole thing just falls apart immediately.
Right.
Because he's like instinct's basically pragmatism and utilitarianism, whereas the desire goes beyond somehow. And I get what he's saying.
Yeah.
And you can see how that's useful if you're talking to someone who's trapped in an ordered world.
Yep.
But it's almost like Rollins is embedded within the Petersonian world. Rollins isn't outside it. And so his critique is just like I think he has a point about, you know, some of the things, like where he talks about desire being fueled not by just the object, but the not having the object, the gap, the lack. Like, I think that's really nice. Like, I think that's really nicely done. So it's not just the object that possesses you. It's also not having the object or not being able to get it. And like, if for an evangelical, and for me, when I was like trapped in the, like, trying to reach after God, it's like maybe you're not exactly addicted to God. You're addicted to not getting him. And then you're like, oh. And then that's super helpful to be like, okay, what am I actually doing? Like, what's my motivation? I don't know. Do you have any thoughts so far on?
I do.
Without like I said, giving away your video.
Well, it's okay. I give it away. I give it all away. But what's it? So he's got instinct, and his point that, you know, by instinct we eat, but we only eat enough. Desire, he's really talking about addiction, where in a sense we are. Well, what's the addiction's very complicated. One side of addiction is I eat food because I'm longing to fulfill a desire that
food can't actually satisfy.
Right.
And so I eat more than I need. So there's instinct and then there's desire. And see, at the same time, well, you got it in my last long video that I did when I went to Peter Kreeft and the argument from desire.
Yeah, I was thinking about that.
Because C.S. Lewis's point is that, and Peter Kreeft develops this then, is that we have a desire for that which we cannot lay our hands on. And I liked the, even though I said some critical things and people kind of got upset that I said Mate, or this guy that Rebel Wisdom had, who talked about addiction. And I'd like to watch. I need about 10 times more time than I have now. I can't do everything, but I want to watch more of that guy. And I want to read his book because he really grabbed my attention. And but there's this connection with addiction that we are longing for something that we cannot satisfy with the things at hand in this world. And that's at the basis of C.S. Lewis's argument that he puts forth in Mere Christianity and a number of other places that Peter Kreeft lays out, that this is part of what's going on in us. And so when I was listening to Peter Rowlands, I was thinking, yeah, but here's the problem that I have with the idea, here's the problem that I have with the idea of romantic Marxism, that people can somehow employ this and bring about justice, equity, all of these things. You're talking to the addicts here. They are already misusing food or substances or control really in other people's lives or sex or whatever. And now you're saying, oh, well, just all be fair. And it's like, have you met an addict? Have you met a person? You know, just talk to them and tell them and they'll do it. I'm a pastor. It's my job to stand in front of people and talk to them. And so I've said this before. I love it when people come to me, Pastor, why don't you tell the people to do this? And it's like, yeah, that's going to change them? Really? Have you ever seen that happen? You know, there's the old story of the pastor who gets up and preaches the same sermon he preached last week, and then he repeats it like 3 or 4 times, and everybody's like, Pastor, why are you repeating the same sermon? I'm going to keep repeating it until you do it.
Right.
People don't work that way. And so this idea that, you know, at least capitalism tries to harness our disease in order to bring something about, you know, that's not just Ayn Rand.
Yeah.
That idea is out there much broader than that. So,
right.
So there are a lot of ideas in that. And I also think there's a parasitism to certain kinds of leftism that I noticed, you know, even when the left just keeps winning the social conflicts, they're always posturing themselves as the victim and they're always losing. And it's like, well, what war haven't you won? And, right. And so then at some point you have to ask them, oh, so with what will you be satisfied? And now I'm asking, who's doing instinct and who's doing addiction? Because, right. Okay, so here's this frontier. What boundary don't you cross until you just run out of boundaries? And right. Then you begin to realize you're just addicted to crossing boundaries. Mm-hmm. At what cost? So, you know, it's so funny because he talks about, you know, he's very right on some things. You want to get to know what homeless is about? Talk to a homeless person. Peterson actually says that in his question and answer video. I talked to plenty of homeless people and it's like, I learned tons from them, but I also recognize the misery. I mean, I had this homeless man. He literally slept against my door right. For 5 years. And I'd be here at night working in my office because I'd split shift because I'd homeschool. And all people aren't going to like the language I'm about to use, but this is what he would do. He would lean against that door. He was bipolar. And he would just be, fuck, 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 fuck. Want to die. 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 I hate to live. He would do this for,
oh my gosh,
he would do this for hours. And, you know, I couldn't move the guy. And, you know, and I, you know, I'd feed him, I'd help him, I'd drive him to the house, I'd do all kinds of things for him. But I'd be sitting in my office and you would just have a front row seat to what it was like for him to live. And it's like, all right, is this guy your model of what life is supposed to be? I've seen it up close. You know, it's really complicated, but no.
Right.
I don't wish this on anyone. So I think there's a dynamic going on where I think you're right. And I think Peterson's chaos order is a helpful framework to work through some of this stuff, mm-hmm. but I don't find a there with what I hear from that crowd often. You keep deconstructing until you're sitting with a floor full of Legos.
Yeah, he deconstructs stuff, and then he leaves the results kind of unspoken. So he's like, if you just deconstruct it, the natural thing will just happen. And he wants to be very hands-off with it because, I mean, just like he grew up in Northern Ireland, or at least Ireland, during the Troubles.
Right.
And so, like, these are ordered factions, you know, in conflict with each other. So he wants to get rid of like whatever that is that's ordered and also conflicting. So, but I lost my train of thought.
Well, and I think, and that's often what I see is they're like, well, here it is. And it's like, what do I do with it? You know, okay, what do I do with it? I need a path to live on. And the thing that often strikes me too about, and I've seen this in other groups, all right, so you're always pushing against the man, you're always pushing against the institution, you're always pushing against the establishment, but you know what? You draw a salary, you have medical benefits, you ride on planes, you ride in cars, you might not own one, good for you. You still ride in them, you take the bus. I mean, we all live on this infrastructure and we live off it. And so one of the things that if you live in a very chaotic space, one of the things you learn is you hunger for order. You know, live in the Dominican Republic where the lights are always going off for whole hosts of endless reasons. And what do you come back to the United States? And it's like they plug clocks into
the wall. But but what's weird is he leaves all that unspoken. But it's not weird if you think about like. In evangelical Protestant culture or just church culture, you talk about the order and you leave all the doubts unspoken.
Right.
Like you can't talk about doubts.
Right.
So when I was going through this, Rollins really opened something up is because I could vocalize doubt and I wouldn't be judged. In fact, in Rollins' framework, vocalizing doubt actually brings you closer to God than if you don't. So It's almost like a mirror image of the evangelicalism that I grew up in. Here you don't speak about doubt, and here you don't speak about belief.
Yep. I won't mention his name, but a guy I converse with a lot on Twitter, who's one of the guys that sent that video to me. I mean, what you just said, he said to me, you know, we didn't post our conversation. Right. You know, but that's very, very true. And you see, that's I always find that funny because that's not the church I grew up in. My father's church was, you know, we had heroin addicts and we had poor black folks living in all kinds of ugly, difficult chaos. But then we also had Dutch Reformed folks who were pretty high on order. And so in terms of where I grew up and the faith that was instilled on me, it always had order, chaos, and they always lived next to each other. And so when I would go to really high order places that didn't have that chaos, I get that. I get people busting out. Well, my father's church was, so it was a black church with some Dutch Reformed, children of the Dutch Reformed community in it. And I think, both groups were, both the African Americans who were coming to the church and the Dutch Reformed people who were coming to church. And this was in the 60s and 70s. So there's a lot of order chaos stuff going on. Mm-hmm. You know, and so that church, Northside Chapel in Patterson, became a place where both sides, sorry, I got this cold. Both sides were dealing with, I mean, the black folks were looking for some order. And the white folks were looking for some chaos.
Right.
And they found it together. And it was a really beautiful thing. And that's the history of this church that I'm pastoring now, too. So I think you're very right.
That's interesting.
What do you I just don't know. I watch a lot of, because, you know, there's this whole progressive evangelical movement that's going on now, the, you know, kind of the tail end of the emergent movement. And I watch these people who grew up in highly ordered places, and they're going out and they're deconstructing. And
right.
And I'm just like, eh, I'll wait. I'll wait.
Yeah. I'm in these Peter Rollins Facebook groups and stuff. He has his own kind of theology name called pyrotheology. So it's the theology that continuously burns anyway. But like these younger guys, so I'm 39, and so there's these younger guys coming in, they're like 20, 25, and they're going through their deconstruction after growing up in it, and they're like, and I'm like, oh, everyone's going through this, and I just like can't get involved. Cause I keep trying to be like, no, you got to value the order. But
save your breath. They'll find
I know.
It's out there.
I don't even engage. Yeah. I go through the. There was one Facebook group I was a part of called the Liturgists. It's some podcast, and they talk about deconstruction all the time. It's this whole thing.
Yep.
And I had to leave that group because I could, like, just reading all those posts, I was like getting anxious. I was like, oh man, they're just going through it.
Well, take some of those people and well. Often what'll happen is, okay, have a baby.
Right.
Because you can, if you're young and single or even married without, I mean, you can, and you're from a high order place and you've already got that order internalized within you.
Right.
You know, yeah, you kept your passport when you went overseas. You protected it. You kept your money and you're able actually to leave the country when, I mean, a lot of people who grew up in high order cultures don't realize those are achievements.
Right.
So cross over on the other side and, yeah, get a load of that chaos, baby. You'll be looking for some order pretty darn quick, especially when you bring a child into the world. And then suddenly it's like, oh, crap.
Right. Well, a lot of them, like when they have kids, they're like, how do you guys deal with this when you're like, oh, you're about to figure out that like some rules are good and you're going to want to cling to that for sure.
That's right. Yeah, you let that little kid be you see how that goes, not taking care of the kid or giving the kid no boundaries. Or
well, some of them are actually trying to raise their kids in like this freer environment. And I'm like, that kid's going to grow up and he's going to want to wear a suit and a tie and he's going to want to work in an office. And that's going to like fuel his soul because his parents were just too crazy.
talk to the children of hippies, baby. Talk to the children of alcoholics. Talk to the children of drug addicts. Talk to the children of neglect. Boy, they'll take to order faster than you can imagine. And some of them will get really rigid with their order fast because, okay, instinct and desire. What shalom, what heavenly country are they looking for?
Mm-hmm.
And they're doing it through order. Well, others are doing it through chaos. It's an old story.
Yeah. What's funny, I was thinking about Lewis's desire. So he had that. Who was it that you played on that last video?
Peter Kreeft.
Yeah, Peter Kreeft talked about that the argument from desire was actually a negative version of God. I forget how he phrased it. It was an interesting phrase he used. This isn't actually like a negative argument. Like the lack of something proves that there's something there.
Right.
But in Peter Rollins' work, he posits that lack, that desire, and then he says instead of going where Lewis said is like this is the proof of God, he's like that's what we need to undermine.
Right.
So in Peter Rollins' work, he's trying to undermine that to obviously, like if that's an addiction or something, you want to get under that or whatever. And that's where the psychoanalysis comes in, and the Lacan and all those guys that I don't even understand. I can't even. But
and I think if you really want to mine that vein, look to the ancient Greek cynics.
Oh, really?
Because, well, the cynics, I mean, at some point, so you're going to sit there and tell me, well, what implicit in the practice of deconstructing is, in fact, a whole degree of higher order. You know, a cynic might just pull the, oh, you've invited me here to instruct you. I'll pull down my pants and take a dump on your stage. There's a learning lesson in order of chaos. You know, really? I mean, let's deconstruct. Let's not play around with, you know.
Yeah, there's those crazy avant-garde artists that would push all those limits, and that's exactly what they're trying to do.
Trying to break
all those barriers.
That's right. And this is, in, you know, we've been doing this for a while, but you're exactly right. You've got super high order kids who've grown up in super high order, and, you know, but that was the, you know, so I mentioned George Marsden's book, The Twilight of the American Enlightenment. I mean, he runs through that in the 50s. It's very interesting because, you know, well, what did it take for America to win the Second World War? I mean, the whole country had to buckle down and suffer. And this was right after the Depression. And we're going to buckle down and suffer in this existential crisis. And we're going to beat Germany and Japan. And, well, then the 50s has all of this angst in it about order. And what then was the company man, today would be the non-player character.
Right.
And so Marsden's book nicely goes through all of that. And that really gives birth to the 60s. In the 60s, it's like, you know, screw order. You know, let's be out there. Look, all right, go for it. Be out there. How's that go? It's a heck of a lot of fun until, you know, unless you're the baby that's being handed around the commune.
Right.
Maybe it'll go okay. Maybe it won't. That's why you pick babysitters.
Right. Yeah, the Manson family kind of ended that whole...
I'm old enough to remember the 70s.
Right. I was born in 79. So.
Yeah, the 70s. You know, it's it's when the 70s is the end of the 60s party. When, you know, it's Vietnam. And then, of course, who comes on stage but Reagan. You know, so Jimmy Carter is the end of the 70s, and he's telling America, we've got an oil crisis, put on a sweater. Reagan comes in and new conservatism. It's the bright, you know, let's get rid of all this negativism. And it's, well, Reagan is in a sense a new synthesis. He's a Hollywood actor, a divorced president who comes in with a bright, shiny new day. Yeah. And so, you know, We've been processing this stuff for a long time.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to bring up one more thing before we go.
Yep.
It was just like Paul Maxwell. He had a video called the Entire History of Philosophy. Did you ever see that one?
Someone else sent that video to me. Mary did. Mary, who I had a conversation with. She said, you got to watch this video.
Yeah, it was good. I like how he broke down into metaphysics. He's like, there's three major branches. So it's metaphysics, epistemology, knowledge, and then axiology. And I like how he, at the very end, when he's like, postmodernism's all about axiology. It's about values, degrees. It's about aesthetics. And I was like, oh, that's it. That's exactly it. And he's like, they're front-loading aesthetics instead of front-loading knowledge or the metaphysics. And that also, of course, I sent you a video. You probably get a billion videos, but it's Phyllis Tickle.
And
did you ever watch that?
I watched some of it. Yeah. Very interesting.
The first part's good. The last part isn't as good.
I heard the idea before though.
But she talked about how the church is always going through these authority crises every 500 years.
Yeah.
So is in 1000, it was the Pope was instated or something. I'm going to get it wrong. Anyway, 1500 was the Reformation, And the question was, where's the authority? Because the Pope wasn't reliable as an authority.
Right. Authority so of the text.
The word. And you could see the move from metaphysics to epistemology at that point, because now the text, the knowledge, became the authority. And then she was saying that right now we're going through another one of these 500-year cycles, whatever it is. But I think it's interesting that it would correspond with the spirit. So it's the age of the spirit, and it corresponds with aesthetics and this axiology that it's no longer grounded in knowledge or metaphysics. It's grounded in, I don't know, whatever the postmodern thing is, where you're concerned with ethics primarily. It doesn't matter. And you can see clearly how it's working, because it doesn't matter what the ramifications are. You just have to treat everybody fairly all the time and make sure the systems do all that. And so, you know, yeah, I just thought that was really interesting.
It is. It's a good video. It's a good video. He walks through it quite. He's got a real gift for laying things out.
Yeah.
And
then at the very end, he said the key to it is the metaphysical has to reach out and touch them. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's it. I was like, that's really good. Then complete the cycle.
No, he's interesting, and I'll have to talk to him one of these days. There's just so many videos.
I know.
So many books and videos. And there's so little me. At least all my videos are around.
Well, anymore, I just watch your videos and get caught up on everything. Because you like just go through everything. I'm like, I don't even need to watch this next Peterson video, whatever.
But the more you go through, the more you realize is out there. And yeah. You know, and it's been great. I shouldn't complain. I have absolutely nothing to complain about. This has been tremendously fun.
You made a video where you just complained about everything. You're like, this is pollen. I'm going to set the record straight.
No, that would be miserable. Some people would like it. I mean, it's amazing that whatever you put out there, somebody's going to hit somebody's sweet spot, and somebody's going to hate it. So
yeah, just consider it like an experiment in postmodern aesthetics.
Oh.
All right. Well, it's about that time, huh?
Yeah, well, thank you, Jess. This has been fun.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. It's really great.
And thanks for sharing your story. I think...
Yeah, sorry I cried. I'd break down for you.
Don't be sorry. What's to be sorry about?
There's nothing to be sorry about. It's just I got to say it for some reason.
Well, you know, if it were manipulative... There was one... I won't mention his name, but there was one celebrity pastor... That I was going to a conference with a friend of mine, and he said, "You just wait; he'll cry." Right, you know. But my friend's point was, it's manipulative, right. You know. And pastors, you know, bring it to this point, and you know, it's. But it wasn't manipulative, so.
Okay. Well, thanks.
Should I share? Should I share this?
Yeah, I think so. I think everything's all right.
Okay, I can send it to you first if you'd rather.
No, it's good.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Jess.
Thanks for talking with me, Paul.
All right. Take care.
All right. See you later.
Bye-bye. Bye.